Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
All right, so hopefully we'll be able to finish today. We'll see if we can get through all of it. There's a little bit left still. To conclude, Refersh's approach to this particular story, we are on page 374. 374, verse 13. We began this briefly at the end of last week's session. We'll just start up with this again. So we're up to in our story in verse 12 on the top of the page. Avraham has bound up his son Isaac, placed him on top of the Mizbech, on top of the altar, reached out for the knife when the angel of God stretches, calls out to him twice, Avraham, Avraham, and says to him here in verse 12, do not stretch out your hand towards the lad, nor do anything to him, because now I know that you fear God and did not withhold my son, your only son, from me. So here we have the angel calling out and saying, you have successfully passed, navigated this test. I know that you actually, in fact, fear Hashem, that you haven't withheld your son from me. And what takes place over here in verse 13, Avram then lifts up his eyes and looked, and behold, there was a ram, after which it became caught in the hedge by its horns. We'll have to discuss this, or first we'll explain why, what does the term mean when it says, like, afterwards it became caught in the thicket by its horns. And Avraham went, took the ram, offered it up as a sacrifice instead of his son. The two phrases now, just in summary, that we're going to now address, that Refersh is going to tackle, which we have mentioned ourselves, is number one, why is it necessary at all for Avraham to offer a sacrifice? The story is about the test. Are you willing to take your son Isaac and offer him to me as a sacrifice? And we haven't really even addressed yet exactly what that test was, what Hashem wanted from Avraham. But on the basic level, we have this story as we've gone through. I've given you a command that goes against the grain of everything you understand, everything you've known me, God, to represent. And I've asked you to do that, to make this ultimate sacrifice for me. And he's been willing to do so. So once the angel stops him, so success. Like, we did it. I was given this test, this difficulty, this trial, and Avram was able to navigate it. Go home. And we see not that that's not what happens. He feels the need to offer up this sacrifice. He sees the ram and he offers it as a sacrifice. And we ask the question, like, why is that so significant? And we answered that on our own. That it wouldn't seem right. And he had all of these preparations, he's got all of this spiritual energy ready to go. It's like the archer with his bow has pulled it all the way back. Like, the energy's ready to be released, so he brought it as a sacrifice. Okay, which I think is a fair response. But Refersh is going to address the significance, the cosmic significance of the fact that there needed to be a conclusion of this test, even though that wasn't what he was asked to do. There has to have been some form of an animal. And I would add this concept to the last phrase in this verse. The Torah stresses, he offered it up as a sacrifice instead of his son. That phrase, not only is it extraneous in the story, seems to be adding something. That not only did he feel the need that he needed to bring the korban, but then somehow this korban, this sacrifice, becomes instead of his son. We don't need that. Why don't we just go with the answer that we gave? He's the archer who pulls his bow back. There's a certain energy, and he wanted to fulfill that, so he brought a sacrifice. That sacrifice doesn't have to be considered instead of his son. He brought a sacrifice. He had gotten to this point. He's on the mount that God had chosen. So he brought a sacrifice. But the Torah seems to stress that the sacrifice that Avraham is bringing is in place of his son. Refersh is going to pick up on these concepts and explaining how this is not an insignificant end of the story. The Torah continues with this part, and it's actually a significant part of the story of the binding of Isaac. Okay, let's start again from the beginning of verse 13. Vayu saw. On that he looked around. Now that he's had the angel call out to him, and the angel tells him, don't do anything, do not even touch him, Avraham looks around. He felt the urge to dedicate the sacrifice. This Arkud and He'akad. Arkud is the one who was bound, or the one who bound Avraham, and He'akad, the one who was bound, referring to Avraham and Isaac together. this free-willed surrender of one's whole being with hand and foot on the altar. So you have Abraham who's willing to bind up his son, and Isaac himself who's free will giving up of his entire essence, which he had been ready to do in actuality. And Abraham had the urge now, by a symbolic offering, to be the tenor of the whole future life of his son and the descendants of his son. And now this is what we read again this briefly last week, that Abraham felt the need to now put into practice to create the tenor of all the future history of Jewish life, that not only was Isaac just ready to, it wouldn't have done it. It wouldn't have been enough to have just, I got onto the altar. Something has to have symbolically, actually been sacrificed to fulfill that which we were ready to do, to give up our whole selves for God, that needed to be symbolically, actually played out. So that his son Isaac and the descendants of his son, you and I, are living that embodiment of that which Abraham fulfilled. Just as Isaac had been ready to sacrifice himself on the altar of God, and had risen up to life from the altar of God, so is the same feeling and the same cheerful readiness for sacrifice to be the vow expressed in offerings by him and his children, and fulfilled in life. And that's going to be the life that we are all going to fulfill, that we are ready, able to sacrifice everything, ourselves, and yet rise up to live again, and that same cheerful readiness is going to be expressed through the offerings of our children. You know, we don't have offerings anymore, but that the offerings that the children of the Jews would bring would be that same expression of what Isaac himself was ready to do. Isaac's life in italics. Isaac's life and the life of his children are to form an eternal Akedah. So that our lives are going to be lived as one long and continuous sacrifice of giving up our lives for the sake of our Creator. Now, this is how Refersh, this is where we got up to, right?
Yes.
This is how Refersh now expressed this. So did we actually read this? I don't remember. I think we did, right?
I don't think so.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he doesn't translate it, so I'll translate it as we go along. The background is as follows. There are two sacrifices in the Beis HaMikdash when the Holy Temple stood. There were two daily sacrifices which were brought every single day without fail, including Shabbos, Yom Tov, every day. One was brought in the morning, and that was the first offering that was brought. No other sacrifice could be brought before that one.
Is that an animal?
Yeah.
What did they do with all these dead animals?
Some were burned completely, some were given to the Kohanim to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Different animals, different sacrifices had different aspects.
The rationalized having killing animals twice a day, though.
Yeah, well, they brought many more sacrifices than that daily. There were a lot. It's a different world. We have to retrain ourselves to think in what refers to actually what we're going to read about today in terms of what was the symbol. We started, actually, he discussed it last week, the symbolism of giving up of oneself. It wasn't this appeasement of some god from some magical thing where you stand next to your sacrifice, but really you are bowing down in prostration as the sacrifice is being given, because it represents the giving up of ourselves, of our own being, our own desires, our own will, our own talents for the sake of our Creator. But this is a difficulty, the whole concept of the sacrifice. You're asking a fair question, and Refersh is really trying to address that with this piece here.
What about lighting a fire on Shabbos for the sacrifice?
Yeah, so good question. One is not permitted to light a fire even for a sacrifice. Uh-huh. And I don't know that either. Some of these things were there was more of a miraculous aspect of fire descending from heaven. And otherwise, I don't know if it would necessarily be burnt on the altar on Shabbos, because you can't. I'm pretty sure you
so
can't light a fire.
An internal.
They did have an eternal flame. Yeah, there were flames that are always there anyway, so they probably used those. I'm not really sure how to answer that question.
But you said every day. So.
Yeah, they did do it every day.
Yeah.
I don't think they let the fire on Shabbos. I don't think so. But I'm not sure. I really just don't know.
Okay.
So one was called the Tamid. They both were called the Korban Tamid, the continuous or continual offering, because they were offered all the time. One was in the morning and one was in the late afternoon, and that would be the end of the sacrifices. The last offering of the day was the afternoon sacrifice. when the sages established our three times of prayer corresponding to the sacrifices, so Shacharis was corresponding to the morning sacrifice, and then Mincha was corresponding to the afternoon sacrifice, and then Marav was the burnings of the fats and the insides which were burned over the on the altar throughout the night. But those were the two sacrifices done continuously, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. They were offered in the north area of the Mizbeach. Whatever the Torah told you that there was a sacrifice to be brought, it also told you where it was to be offered within the Beis HaMikdash, where on the altar it was to be, on the north side, on the south side, east side, west side. Different areas on the Mizbeach, on the altar, had different sacrifices offered on it. These continual offerings were in the Tzafon. Tzafon is the way of saying north. The northern area of the Mizbeach, Lefnei Hashem, before Hashem, on the north side of the Mizbeach, he would bring this offering. Tzafon, for north, has another meaning in Hebrew, which, as I mentioned last week, it's Pesach time. It's part of the Hallel Seder, the Pesach Seder. Tzafon Barech Hallel Nirtza. Anyone remember what's Tzafon?
You told us.
Right? Tzafon is that which is hidden. Right? Because the Afikoman had been hidden away, put aside to the end of the meal. And now we eat afikomen before we bench. So tzafun also means something hidden. So Rav Hirsch is going to pick up on the fact that when there's going to be a medrash. Sages picked up on this, and Rav Hirsch is going to expound upon the medrash. The sages picked up that these two continuous offerings, morning and night, every day in the Beis HaMikdash, we are told to bring them in the tzafon, in the north. And that the alternate meaning, sometimes the sages often did this when they expounded on the depths of the Torah uses a specific word, they would read into it, even though the simple meaning is the one word, but since there's an alternate meaning, they would see in the fact that the Torah chose that word with alternate meanings, other layers of meaning within what's being said. So the fact that the daily offerings were being offered in the tzafun, in the hidden part of the Mizbeach, so to speak, that which is, as a Hirsch is going to understand it, that which is dark, that which is where you can't see, you're in the dark, so to speak, and you'll offer these offerings. Let's see the Medrash inside. I'll read it and translate. The Medrash says as follows. The identification, last paragraph on page 374, the identification of the person in his offering, meaning that the person himself identifies with the offering. I'm giving here an animal, but I identify myself as being represented in the offering. That's established with this phrase, this greatest pithiness of Ayol Tachas Bino, that the offering that Avraham offered was in place of his son. That phrase, which did not need to be there at all, and is added, is teaching us that when Avraham felt this urge, I need to actually bring an offering, and it's in place of my son. I see within this offering the fulfillment of that which I really desire to be able to do, which was to be able to bring my son. Say the sages as follows. Oso yom shehe elo avinu Avraham es Yitzchak b'no agave amizbech. On that day when Avraham placed his son Yitzchak bound up on top of the altar, Hashem established on that day that there were going to be two daily offerings in the Beis HaMikdash. Keves echad v'shachris v'achas bein ha'arbaim. One would be in the early morning and one would be in the afternoon. So that the measures, the sages of the Talmud see, in Avraham's act of placing his son Isaac on the altar, God Himself says, on that day, I am going to establish for His children the continuation of this process, which will be manifested in the daily offerings of the temple, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. Why? So that every moment when the Jewish people, or at the moment when the Jewish people will bring these continual offerings on the Mizbeach, and will read the Pasuk, Tzafona Lefnei Hashem, that it should be brought in the north part of the altar before Hashem. But the sages saw, not only should you bring it in the north, but you should bring it in times that are hidden, black, dark times in Jewish history before Hashem, that Hashem will remember during those times the Akedah. He'll remember what it was that began this process of these offerings, that Avram was willing to put his own son on top of the altar. And testifies every time a person reads these verses of in the north or in the hidden parts before Hashem, I will remember for you the binding of Isaac. That's the Medrash. That's what the sages have to say. Rav Hirsch expounds upon it on the top of page 375. There too, the daily offering in the temple is taken to be just a national continuation of the Akedah of the forefather. So that the sages see that in our daily offerings, when were they established? When Avram placed his son, God says, I'm going to give his children a method to continue this every day. Morning and evening, every day, you'll be able to continue on a national level that which Avraham began for us. And especially the command, Tzafona Lifnei Hashem, as the Medrash picks up on the phrase, on the north side, on the hidden side, before Hashem. That the holiest offerings had to be brought before Hashem on the midnight side of the altar. Right, and he's using his body, the alternate meaning. Reading, the simple meaning is on the north side of the altar. But it means on the dark side, on the midnight side of the altar, is taken in connection with it. It says at first, what does that mean, the midnight side of the altar? In the midnight of life, when the sun far beneath us, around us all darkness. Midnight is, you can't see. It represents, in other words, in Jewish thought, the way that God created the world, which he did not have to do it this way, he could have just as easily created two suns. And as easily as God created one sun, he could have created two, could have created a world which revolves around so that there's always, you know, well, the earth goes around the sun, there could have been other suns out there. Could have been done in a way where there's always daylight. And he didn't. The world is created, he created Vayehi Erev, Vayehi Voker. He created night, created day. He created periods where you can't see. It's black, darkness, and then periods of light. And Jewish history has followed that path, as does our own personal lives often, where there's periods of darkness. Just like, can't see, I'm groping around, I don't know what's going on. And then the sun begins to shine. And then it becomes illuminated. Then we go plunged back into darkness. And there's a cycle. Jewish history is following that cycle. If we live in a time of electricity. We're not affected by the dark in as much as they have been in previous generations. And we are also, but nowhere near like it used to be. When the sun set, like that was it. It was dark. You may have had a little torch, put a little bit of lamp in your light oil in your house, but things stopped to function the way they did during the day. You just couldn't see. Couldn't travel. So in that period of life, says Rav Alter, the sun, says Rav Hirsch, with the sun far beneath us, around us all darkness, and still to say, even if we cannot see, Hashem yireh, but Hashem will see. God does see. To stand at Tzafona, to stand in the midnights of life, lifnei Hashem, we stand before Hashem, to say, God has insight. He can see for us, no need for insight into the insight of God. Even if I don't have insight into His insight, neither His law nor His manner of ruling need to justify themselves before the tribune of our understanding, and we don't need to understand it. Right? We don't need to justify His law, we don't need to justify His rulings, the way that He runs the world. We don't sit in a tribunal to judge that, we're in the dark. But He sees. Whatever the conditions may be here below, whatever the conditions here are, Hashem yireh, Hashem sees. Such is the institution of the eternal offering on Moriah. Now, to fill in where he's coming from, we're going to talk about this again in a moment. He's coming from verse 14, the very next verse. What does Avraham name this place? Avraham looks up in verse 13, like we've been reading. He sees the ram, he offers it up. Avraham called the name of that place Hashem Yireh, God sees. V'hayom Asher Yeyamer Hayom, on which is expressed today of Behar Hashem Yeroeh, the Mount of God, one is seen. Now we're going to get to this verse. It's a very tricky pasuk that he named it God sees, and today it's called that God, we will be seen before God. What he's borrowing from that now is simply the idea that Avram names this place God sees. And he's saying, I was totally in the dark. made no sense. I'm asked by a God of kindness, by a God of love, by a God who I've dedicated my life to for Him, and He tells me to sacrifice my son. And it goes against all logic. If you remember, I first pointed out that God had to give the command, but only an angel had to stop it. Because the angel stopping it was like restoring order to the world. Like, that made sense that you're telling me not to do this. But when God told me to do this, it's absurd. The first one so far to say that if an angel had told Avraham, Avraham would have said, no way. Like, something is wrong. I don't know what. Some wire got crossed that an angel of God is telling me to kill my son. That's how absurd the whole concept was. So God Himself has to say, I'll do it. And so what does Avram name the place? Hashem Yireh. And when I'm in the dark, when I can't see, when I don't get it, and it doesn't make sense, and it is absurd, from man's perspective, it's absurd. It's the midnight of life. And He names the place, but God sees. I don't have to see. I would almost, you know, point out from here in terms of like, what was the test? The test was for Avram to go through life in this world and be able to say, I don't get it. It doesn't make sense. But Hashem yireh. But Hashem sees. And the tribunal of His law, or in Rafersh's language, His law, His way of running the world does not need to sit before our human tribunal to judge whether or not it works or it doesn't work, if it makes sense or not. We follow and we say, Hashem Yireh, I name the place, and that is the institution of the eternal offering on Moriah, says Rafersh. The eternal offering that's brought is the Jew saying, I will follow, I don't get it, and Hashem Yireh, but you see and you do. And we could say this 1,000 times. This is the concept that the Jew, that the world struggles with, a God that we don't get. I forgot who said this, if it was Rabbi Beryl Wein or if it was Rabbi Akiva Tetz, like on some lecture that I was listening to on a recording, that was once questioned by somebody that said, I don't understand, how could you follow the precepts of a God, look in the world, and life doesn't make sense? There are so many questions that we have. There's so much pain, there's so much suffering, the wicked seem to prosper, those who are good are suffering, all the classic questions which we can ask. And how do you live your life for a God, and we don't get Him? His response was, well, there's no way I would live my life for a God that I did understand. If I understood Him, so then I could be God. What do I need Him for? It's only a God that I don't understand that's a God worth living for, to give up one's life for, because it's bigger than us. And at the same time, that's the biggest difficulty we have to live our lives according to that and say, I could say that cute little story, but then to actually live a life when I don't get it, that's the balance, that's the difficulty. And the eternal institution, the accomplishment, the eternal offering of Mount Moriah, the Avram saying, the pinnacle of this makes no sense. And Hashem Yireh. But Hashem sees. And what does Hashem establish for us as children from this event? In the morning and at night you'll bring an offering which will be a continuation of the Akedah. And where do you offer it? Bitzafon, in the hidden midnights of our lives before God, when we can't see, when all is dark, and we are able to say, but you see, and this offering is my giving up of myself for you in that sense. Continuing on, that was why Avraham looked for an animal. So this says the first, now getting back to our other question on the verse, like, why did he have to bring an animal? Why did he have to look? Why he's picking up on the phrase, Vayisoes Einav. He like lifted up his eyes. He was looking for something. Why was he looking for an animal? For words were insufficient. At this moment in which Avram had given up everything and been told that he had passed, but God doesn't really want him now to sacrifice his son, the words would not have been enough. He needed to do something. He needed to express that in a symbolic offering. And see, as he looks up, what does he see? There stands a ram. And achar, afterwards, after he had first seen it, it became caught by its horns in a bush. Avram then took it and brought it as an offering in place of his son. These words, which we have stressed, meaning that the offering was in place of his son, are a striking refutation of that narrow-minded or malicious misconception which disputes the symbolic meaning of our offerings. He's going back to what we discussed last week. Remember Abraham Geiger? Right? And the whole idea of the progression of the human race in offerings, that it was some bloodthirsty cult offering to appease some vicious god, and how Avram progressed, in which he realized, no, God doesn't want human sacrifices, he wants animal sacrifices, and then from which we have progressed to say, no, God doesn't even want any sacrifices at all. He's going back there now to say that last phrase, that Avram offered that up in place of his son, is again a striking refutation of that misconception, so as to be able to launch into a proud disparagement of the bloody ritual of offerings. And he's right to continue like that. This is going to refute that. How? Because if offerings had no symbolic meanings, if it wasn't actually symbolic of something far more significant, if the offering of this ram did not express a much higher and much more meaningful giving oneself up to God, then what blasphemy or what an absurdity would it be to say that it was tachas b'no in place of his son? Now, I want to, before we read it inside, because his words are so poetic, let's just give the background of what he's about to say. We asked a question on this offering. And generally, if you give an offering, I'd say, what's the sacrifice that a person is giving when they bring a sacrifice? Like, meaning sacrifice in the regular way we use it. What is he giving up when he brings a sacrifice?
His own possession.
His own possession. I have an animal. It's a big deal for me to take from my livestock a cattle, just monetarily. The simple monetary value of a cow is significant. And I either buy a cow in Jerusalem or I take my own livestock. But either way, what goes up onto the altar to God is a real dedication from who I am. And what does Avram bring?
His son.
He wanted to bring his son, and he doesn't. What does he bring instead? Whose ram is it?
God, Hashem.
There's some random ram on the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
So, like, a big deal. So what? What did he give up? What did he do? He didn't do anything. He didn't take anything of himself. And if I go up to the Holy Temple, and I'm looking around and say, oh my goodness, I forgot to bring a sacrifice. I see you got two. You turn your back. I quickly whip up your cow and I offer it. I'm like, well, what's that? That's not mine. Why is that meaningful? So what did Avram accomplish by finding this wild goat, wild ram on the top of a mountain and offering it up as a sacrifice? Says the first, it's actually very significant. Not only is it significant, but the Torah uses the words in adding to his question, that, and what was this animal? Tachas b'no, in place of his son. So wait a minute. What's the most precious thing to Avram in the entire world? Son, no question about it. He's not just because it's a regular father-son relationship. Yitzchak represents Avram's entire life. He has come on his own to the recognition of a God in the world. He's lived his whole life dedicated to teaching that, waited for 80 years to have a child, was promised by God that this child will continue the mission, and through this child will have children as numerous as the stars of the heaven. You're going to create an entire legacy, dynasty of human beings serving the Creator. It's all embodied in this child. And he's willing to give that all up. And then God says, I don't want you to. And then Avram on his own, who was not told to bring a sacrifice, says, I have to. I have to bring something, and what it should be is in place of my son. I should feel that what I'm bringing is... So you just take some random animal that you found? That's going to be a fulfillment of in place of your son? You didn't give up anything. You didn't lose anything. You didn't give up monetary value. You didn't, like, shepherd this animal for a couple of years. You haven't done anything to it. You just met it for the first moment. How can that be called, says Rav Hirsch, it's blasphemy. Imagine you're Yitzchak. And Adam says, this should be in place of my... This? You never saw this animal before. How do you have the audacity to say that it's in place of me? Says the first, again, from the top of the paragraph, if offerings had no symbolic, so if there wasn't a symbolic meaning, then if the offering of this ram did not express a much higher and much more meaningful giving oneself up to God, then it would be a complete blasphemy and absurdity to say, Tachas Bino, instead of the son. Instead of the dearest, most precious thing for which one would sooner have suffered death oneself 10 times over. To substitute an animal that just happens to be running wild in the forest so that it is not even a value of one's own possessions? And this is going to be in place of your most precious son? I haven't seen this. This is like refers like trying to be almost acute, which he's generally not. He's poetic and deep. Somebody has generously given me £1,000,000, and I pick up a pin off the floor and say, "Gee, I don't know how to thank you. Well, why don't you at least take this?" How can you do that? Says at first, this is the proof to what I've been writing about before, that the offering is not an appeasement to some vicious, bloodthirsty God. If it were, and God wanted your son, and you took this instead, it wouldn't have worked. You didn't do anything. But what is it? It's the one giving the offering saying, I see myself here. I put my hands on top and I embody as if I wanted to give up my dreams, my goals, my will, my desire, and all of that is being sacrificed to you. That's the symbolic meaning of what a sacrifice is. I have no other means of giving myself to you. You don't want me to kill myself. That's not the God we have. Does not desire that. So the only expression for that is to take an animal and to offer that, but it's symbolically really giving up of myself. And just forgive me. We have trouble with the concept. But the reason why we have trouble is because the animal is the closest thing to us that would symbolize that. There is nothing else that we could offer that would have any semblance to the idea of a human saying to God, I want to give myself up to you. And because the animal is so similar to us, it strikes us in our Western minds as like, that just doesn't sound right. Why are we killing all of these poor animals? Except that the animals were created for that purpose. But that's where the Western mind clashes with the minds of what the Torah wants us to, in terms of seeing how this works. But that is the proof, says it first, that there has to be a symbolic significance to this offering more than just that appeasement. How else can Avraham claim that this was Tachas Bino, in place of his son, when he just stumbled across a wild goat? Yeah.
What is the significance of the fact that he says that the ram got caught in the thicket after Abraham saw it? I mean, everything you said seems to like it would apply even if when Abraham saw it, it was caught in the thicket.
So that's a good question. It sounded to me, I'm not sure because it seemed like Rashi, if I remember, learned it a little bit differently. It sounded like he was saying it was as a result of his desire to want to symbolically fulfill this Tachas Bino with something, then it became stuck. In other words, at the beginning of the verse says he lifted up his eyes. The verse says, why is he lifting up his eyes? Because he needed to. In other words, at the end of verse 12, we're done. Go home. Angel calls out to God, to Avram, don't do it. I see you're a God-fearing man. You did not withhold your son. End of the story. Except Avraham continues the story in the beginning of verse 13 by lifting up his eyes to look. So Rav Hirsch understood he had the urge, I need to do more. So it sounds like a first thing, and then the animal got caught. That's what it sounds like. Which I believe was different. If I remember correctly, I thought Rashi said that the sages, quoted from the sages, that this animal was prepared from the 6 days of creation already. Like, I don't know if it was, maybe it wasn't just stuck there, it was already designated as such, but...
Otherwise he would have run away, but the fact that he was stuck.
Right, and then he was allowed Abram to go get it. Okay.
Also with the belief that Abraham had, that everything comes from God, when he lifted up his eyes, he saw the ram, and he knew that was from God.
Right.
So, you know, that gives us the symbolism.
Yeah.
Okay, one more?
Still have a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's fine to have a problem with that idea. No, that's how our Western minds have a very great difficulty wrapping our minds around
sacrificing animals. Yeah.
And that's... You know, at different points in history, this is an example of, like, we're brought up in a different culture, mm-hmm. a secular culture, and this is what Rabbi Hirsch was railing against, that in his age, 200 years ago already, they were saying it's the progression of the human spirit not to bring sacrifices, and that's a positive change. To which he's saying, we might not get it, because it's been 2,000 years since we've offered a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. We might not get it, but that's not the way the Torah wants us to view how this... Yeah. Like, it was the fulfillment of the symbolic offering that was a giving up of himself. There's discussion whether or not there'll be sacrifices when the temple is rebuilt. I'm pretty sure the general assumption is we will bring again, but... We'll see. Mr. Hashem, we'll see soon.
And another point to me seems like God is showing his mercy by having the ram stuck to have a sacrifice, not a killing of a son, but a sacrifice,
mm-hmm.
To show that I could have, to me, taking your son wouldn't have been a problem for me. I can take a ram and capture it. Why couldn't I take your son if I wanted it? But there was more to it than that. If for some reason it was a test for Abraham, is what I can only see, a test.
In terms of offering the ram instead?
No, a test that Abraham was willing to give his only son.
Right.
That was the sacrifice. That would have been, and he even says he would have rather died 10 times
right. than have
to
do that.
His own son.
Yep.
So the ram is just part of the whole, what it's called, a miracle. Hashem's mercy.
Okay, very good. Okay, let's get back to verse 14, which is, we started a very difficult verse. So Abram names the place Hashem Yireh. He names the place that even though we live in the midnight of life often, we're in the dark, we don't get it, we can't see. But you, God, see. He names the place Hashem Yireh. And then the verse is a very odd thing. Asher Yeyamer Hayom, on that which is said about it today, which is today is expressed by, Bahar Hashem Yeyroeh. On the mountain of God, one is seen. Now, that's a very... God, Abram names a place that you, God, see. In the way that that manifests itself today, the Torah says, is in that we are seen. Or we switch the perspective. Abram names it from God's perspective. You, God, see. On that which is said today, that we are seen today on that mount. Which are first understand that to be a reference to when are we seen before God on the Temple Mount?
When we come to offer sacrifices.
Okay, when are we required to be seen before God?
On the three.
Festivals, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, when the Jew goes to Yerushalayim. The Torah uses this very same phrase, Bahar Hashem Yeroeh, you shall be seen on the mountain of God. Not empty-handed, but with your sacrifices, when you come for the three pilgrimage festivals, when you come for Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. Says the first as follows, verse 14, by the name Hashem Yireh, when Abram names the place you, Hashem, see, Abram bequeathed the Horah, he bequeathed the teaching, which Moriah is to bring to his descendants, by the remembrance of this event. Meaning when we remember this event, when we learn this event, there's a certain remembrance, there's a certain lesson that we receive from that today. And that is Hashem Yireh. that Hashem, God, sees. That is the lesson that we take from this event, that even when we do not see, God sees. Freely and willingly have we to subordinate our own judgment to His. So again, this is going to answer we had asked a bunch of big questions in the beginning, like what was the test? How would Rav Hirsch understand the test of the Akedah? Will you follow my command when you don't get it? When it makes no sense? When you can't see? And there is no solution. In other words, sometimes we have a problem in front of us, and there's like a solution out there, we're having trouble figuring it out. And sometimes we come to the conclusion of, there is no solution. And Avram had that. This son has been promised to have many, many children like the stars of the heavens. And this son had been commanded to kill him. And he's not even married yet. And there is no solution to that. There's no way out of that. I don't have the answer to that. And I'm going to do it anyway. And I name the place you see to teach that every Jew, when they learn this story, will conclude with these words of the name of the place is God sees. That when we're in the dark, and that's what it means to be a human being who lives in the dark, you, God, still see. God sees, thus Avraham expresses the general meaning of Moriah. That's the entire meaning of this mountain in which Avram finds himself. But today, after this general conviction of God has manifested itself for us in a special act of revelation, the act of the giving of the Torah, and God has given for us His insight into what is good and right for us in His Torah, for which a sanctuary is to be erected on this mount. Meaning, so at that time, Avram saying, you know, it was just a mountain, and God sees. Hashem later manifested Himself and expressed His ability to see us and telling us the insight for what we need to be doing, that which is right, that which is good, through the Torah that He gave us, and the sanctuary which is erected on that mountain, so that we are to live the whole of our lives in accordance with it. Today, this great truth, flipping over the page, 376, is not expressed by the general term of God sees, but that each one of us is seen by God, and has to present himself repeatedly on this mount to be seen, to be testingly inspected. So that we went from a God sees on the mount, to now He gave us the Torah, told us how to live, told us that which is right, that which is good, and then we transferred from the name of the mountain, which was God sees, into it being from our perspective of we will now be seen by God, testingly inspected how we're doing with the insights through the Torah that He's presented to us. Thrice yearly, Yehra, three times every year you shall be seen. Every son of Avraham and Isaac must be seen on this mount. And not Rekam, not empty, with mere inning passing devotion. You don't come on Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot just by yourself, but with the sacrificing dedication of the whole of his being, as expressed in the Olas Re'iyah. The Olas Re'iyah means the complete burnt offering that's brought on the holidays. Every one of the three holidays, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, the Jew would come with at least with several sacrifices. One was special for the holidays of what's called the Olas Re'iyah. I have come with a burnt offering on being seen here in the Beis HaMikdash. And Rav Hirsch then is tying these concepts together of, originally, Avram names the mount, you see me, later to be expressed as, we will be seen before you, and when we are seen before you, we don't come empty, but we come with our own sacrifices, representing what we've just learned a sacrifice represents, representing the Jew's ability to come and say, I would like to dedicate everything that I am, everything that I have, everything that I represent, to you, so that I come with that sacrifice to be seen by you on the mount when Avraham expressed the Jewish ability to say, I will follow your ways because you see me and see the world even when I can't. Everybody who henceforth appears on Moriah with his Olas Re'iyah, therefore every Jew who shows up on the three holidays with his sacrifice, attaches himself to the Ola, attaches himself to the same sacrifice which Avraham brought, Tachas Bino, that Avraham brought in place of his son, and vows to do his part of the Akedah task which his ancestor undertook for his son and his descendants on that spot. So that when we show up with our sacrifice, with our animal about three times a year, we're basically taking our place in line, saying, the same way that Avraham began this process of giving everything that he had to you, we are going to continue that process. And in accomplishing it himself, had pilgrimaged up to the heights of Moriah as an example of all time. Avraham was able to do so, and then we've been following those footsteps, offering that same sacrifice in the same way that he had done as well. How's that?
Good.
All right, let me, it's going to be 5 minutes. Let me just do this next verse. Verse 15 says, an angel of God then called unto Avram a second time from heaven. So first points out, and with this we'll conclude today, why is there like this second calling out after, in other words, if you think of the timeline as to what took place here, we have the first angel calling out, or the first time he calls out and says, stop what you're doing, don't do it. Avram then looks up, he needs to find a sacrifice, offers it in place of his son, and then an angel calls out again and says, look at what the second angel is saying. Verse 16, by myself I have sworn, said God, that because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will bless you, surely bless you and multiply your seed as to the stars of the heaven and to the sand of the sea. Why does Avram receive the blessing of the stars of the heaven and the sands of the sea?
Didn't he already have that?
Excellent. That's question number one. He already had it. Question number two, why is he getting these things? What does the verse say?
Yeah, because he didn't withhold his
son. He didn't withhold his son, right? So if you think about the timeline, it's a little bit odd. The angel calls out and stops him and says, don't do it. What should he have said? I know you're a God-fearing man. What else should he have then said at that time? This verse, and because you've done this thing, you have not withheld your son, I will surely bless you like the stars of the heaven and the sand of the sea. But that's not the chronology here. The angel calls out and says, don't do it, you're a God-fearing man. Then the Torah tells us Avram offers the ram in place of his son. And then the angel calls out a second time and says, because you didn't withhold your son, you'll be blessed in this way. Why did he have to wait till after the sacrifice? Sacrifice was the after effects of this, but it wasn't the reason why he's getting this blessing. Says or first. Shainis, the second time, it was only after Avraham had sacrificed the ram in the place of Isaac and had given the place its name that this announcement of the far-reaching blessing that would accrue to him as a result of his acts was made to him. Meaning it's true. When did he merit this blessing? After bringing the ram and saying, this is the place that God sees, that even when I can't see, I name this place God sees. Why? For with both, he had made this culminating act of his life into the loftiest goal of the whole of his descendants. And in connection with it, the blessing is given to those descendants. It's when he gave an offering in place of his son and provided his children the ability to give that offering, as the Medrash we started with said, in place of his son, that we then receive this new blessing, so that the, and we're going to have to see the next blessing, which we'll do next week. I thought we would finish this today, and we have a week off before Pesach. I hope you guys can make it next Tuesday.
Can you?
I can.
Okay.
I hope.
I can.
In the offering that he gives in place of his son, are we going to merit this blessing, which we're going to have to deal with, but he already received this blessing. So something is going to change in his blessing, And the fact that he receives this new level of the blessing needs to be after the culmination of the whole episode, not just that he was willing to give his son, but that he then completes the act with the symbolic offering in place of his son, giving us the mechanism to do so as well, that he then receives a new aspect of this blessing, which we will see, if you can wait, next week, Mr. Shem.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.